pain is personal. It's hard to describe.
Don't ever ask me again on a scale of 1 to 10, how's your pain today, Mrs. Christopher?
Why the way we measure pain is in the hot seat. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. Here are a few things we're going to do on today's show. We're going to take a hike with a professional noise pollution tracker. Yes, that is a real job. We're also going to meet a group of amateur scientists who are hoping to beat Big Pharma at their own game. And we're going to find out how being in a band could be a lifesaver for stressed out med students. But first up, the language of pain has its limitations. We use words like stabbing, nagging, or burning to describe how we hurt. Doctors and nurses usually ask us to put a number on it, on a scale from 0 to 10, how bad is your pain? And then you start thinking, well, what makes it a number 10 pain? For me, a 10 would probably be a toothache I had a few years ago or the time I slammed my finger into the car door. That was the worst. But when you're seeking treatment for pain, choosing the right number is difficult because if you say 7, maybe you're exaggerating. But if you say 3, perhaps the doctor thinks, well, what are you doing here then? A 3 is not that bad. There is concern that this imperfect tool, assigning a simple number to a really complex problem, has contributed to the nation's prescription drug epidemic, and that it's not leading to good treatment. Pulse reporter Alana Gordon has been digging into where this numerical scale came from and why there's push for a change.
Katie Hicks doesn't remember pain being discussed much when she was a med student. This was in the late 90s in California.
Well, I don't think that when I did medical school, I don't think that was a part of the conversation really at all.
Then, during the first year or two of residency in internal medicine at a county hospital, she noticed a change. Along with checking things like blood pressure and temperature, nurses and doctors started asking patients about the intensity of their pain.
What happened was it showed up on the paperwork first and really in the nursing documentation, and then it became a part of the conversation. It was an additional vital sign, basically.
Hicks doesn't recall any special rollout. It just kind of crept into everything. And so she found herself routinely asking about patients' pain on a scale of 0 to 10 over the course of a patient's stay.
I would be asking you, what was your pain when you came into the hospital and what is your pain now? And especially if somebody was given some type of medication, Tylenol or Motrin or morphine, you would say, what was your pain before you had the medication? What was your pain after you had the medication?
This wasn't just a California thing. Around that time, the use of the pain scale was spreading like wildfire across the country. That's because the early 2000s marked a turning point in the culture of pain in America. Myra Christopher is with the Center for Practical Bioethics in Kansas City. She recalls the specifics of this shift very well. She was part of the movement that led to it.
And this really surprises people sometimes, but in 2000, Congress, in fact, declared the next decade the decade for pain, the decade for improving pain.
President Bill Clinton signed H.R. 3244 into law, making pain control and research a priority over the next 10 years. Christopher says several factors pushed the needle to this point. There had been growing recognition that pain was being vastly undertreated and not taken seriously. The attitude had long been, just suck it up, deal with it, even after surgery. Doctors were extremely cautious of opioids. But this was also a time when a huge portion of the population was getting older and dealing with chronic pain. In the wake of Vietnam and the Gulf War, the military increased its focus on veterans' pain. Professional societies took up the issue, as did drug manufacturers. The Joint Commission, the main hospital accreditation agency, stepped in.
The Joint Commission, in fact, decided that they should make a quality measure about the assessment of pain. And the notion was that if pain was assessed more often, then it would be treated better.
The commission began requiring that hospitals regularly assess pain as a measure of quality. The numerical scale wasn't anything new. But Christopher says it was around this time that the 0 to 10 approach became more institutionalized. Because think about it, numbers are a universal language. Describing pain, not so much.
So we were trying to figure out a way to move from a physician or an advanced practice nurse saying, "How's your pain?" and someone saying, "Oh my God, it's killing me. You can't imagine. I feel like someone's driving nails into my joints," or whatever, to something that was more consistent and congruent with the clinical model.
So those driving nails in your joint would turn into something like an 8. But 0 to 10 wasn't initially designed for addressing patients' pain. It was meant to be a tool to study it.
Okay, mood scales, lower extremity scale, functional scales.
Dr. John Farrer is a pain specialist and biostatistics guy at the University of Pennsylvania. He helps design pain assessments used to study new treatments, and he has spent decades analyzing measurements. To show for it, he opens up this huge drawer next to his desk.
These are all scales.
Wait, you have just like two columns of just manila folders. They're all different pain scales?
Yes.
That's crazy. Farrer's point is there's a lot to defining and measuring pain. And researchers have come up with all sorts of approaches. Some have involved sensory comparisons, or applying some sort of heating pad or a sharp piece of plastic to your skin. As for the scales, there are many. Some are verbal, some use faces. Yes, emoticons were a hit in healthcare way before you could text them on your phone. Farrer says it was the onset of clinical trials right after the Second World War that led to the development and use of pain scales, and more specifically, numerical scales. Researchers wanted a standardized way to measure whether patients were benefiting from a treatment or not. One way to detect that would be to measure whether patients reported changes in their pain score.
From a clinical trial perspective, if the 7 goes down to a 4 and the 5 goes down to a 3, I know both of them got better.
For his own research and care of cancer patients, Farr keeps what's called the Brief Pain Inventory Scale close by.
It contains 4 questions about pain.
It's still brief, but it is a more extensive questionnaire that asks about pain experiences over time, with patients answering on a scale of 0 to 10.
How much does pain interfere with your life?
But even surrounded by all these scales, Farr says a number in and of itself can't be taken as an objective measure. Because in all of these assessments, pain is still self-reported. Your 8 might be different from my 8. And a lot of factors can influence how a person experiences short and long-term pain.
So part of the problem with our pain scales is that no matter how good they would be, they're not adequate to make our own complete assessment about somebody's pain.
A few hundred yards away from Farrer's office, the University of Pennsylvania's emergency room confronts these challenges daily. I asked Dr. Jean-Marie Perrone and Megan Scott, a triage nurse, to show me how pain fits into their intake process.
I can open the ZZZ chart.
Yeah, maybe that would be helpful.
Pain intensity on a scale of 0 to 10 has become a central part of the electronic medical record. Up on their computer screen, I see a special slot where they document the number that a patient reports. There's a space for comments, too. Both Scott and Perrone say lots of people come in here with a 15 out of 10.
We've all seen the greater than 10 on our 1 to 10 scale.
Can you even write that in?
No, that's not an option. You just try to kind of explain it a little bit better and refocus.
Dr. Perrone can't imagine a world without the numeric pain scale. But she and others worry that its widespread promotion has had an unintended outcome. Because measuring pain on a numeric scale has brought with it an expectation to treat that pain, to lower that number.
I think the leap we've made is that we need to get that pain down to 0 or 5, or, you know, in various times we've never really had good guidance on how to decrease the pain and what our endpoints were.
Treating pain is important, but Perrone says doctors she knows have felt pressured to use what limited tools they've had. Opioids have been a big one. Around the launch of that decade of pain about 16 years ago, government agencies issued more proactive opioid treatment guidelines. Meanwhile, pain became part of patient satisfaction measures and reimbursements. The American Medical Association has contended that new formulations, boosted by manufacturers, convinced the world that these drugs were safer and less addictive for treating long-term pain, beyond its more studied use in cancer patients. Dr. Chester Buckenmeyer directs the Defense Department's Center for Integrative Pain Management. He says everyone now realizes that pendulum swung too far.
We've been so focused on intensity
to the exclusion of these other issues that were missing the point with the patient and ourselves, and that pain therapy isn't necessarily about getting your pain intensity to zero.
It's something he calls chasing zero, and the expectation to eliminate pain completely. But there's one problem with this, because enough opioids can do that.
I'm an anesthesiologist. There's nobody on the planet that I can't get their pain to zero, but they're not going to be functional.
Today, in a nation grappling with addiction, rising overdose deaths, and the search for better ways to understand and manage chronic pain, there's been a lot of finger-pointing and backpedaling. Congress has launched investigations. Federal health agencies are revisiting treatment guidelines. They're retooling pain as a quality metric in hospitals and reevaluating the role of pain in patient satisfaction scores. Even the military is reassessing how it assesses pain, giving that 0 to 10 scale a bit of a makeover.
How are we feeling today?
A little uncomfortable.
Okay, well, we'll do our best to get you feeling a little bit better.
This is a clip from a new educational video from the Department of Defense and Veteran Affairs about an augmented pain scale they're rolling out.
It'll allow both of us to better understand how pain is affecting your life.
It still uses 0 to 10, but includes colors, faces, and some qualifying language. There's also questions about mood, stress, sleep, and activity. Buckenmeyer was part of a task force that developed this. He says the scale is just one tool. It won't solve the bigger problem. But he hopes that changing the way pain is assessed can begin to change the attitudes and approaches to treating it. That involves a lot more than trying to completely get rid of pain.
And I think we understand now better that pain is what we call a biopsychosocial experience, meaning it's got physical, emotional, psychological components beyond just that intensity measure.
It all means that doctors, nurses, and patients are navigating a tricky area, trying to find better ways to avoid undertreating, overtreating, and mistreating pain. And at the very least, simply reducing pain down to a single number. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Alana's report brought up so many complex issues, and we wanted to talk a little bit more about how all of this might play out in doctors' offices, especially for physicians who specialize in treating pain. We reached out to Michael Clark of Johns Hopkins University. He is currently in Las Vegas for Pain Week. That is an annual conference. And I was interested in this idea that we just heard about of chasing zero pain. And I asked him how he deals with patient expectations in his office. So a patient comes in, they want their pain to be gone, and maybe he knows that's not going to happen.
First of all, we focus on function. And while I would always like to get somebody to zero pain, I think it's more important for them to appreciate that it's better to be doing the things that they want to do with some pain or discomfort than to try and pursue total pain relief before they attempt to do anything in the rest of their life. So that's the setting of the stage. And then it's a question of saying, we're going to work together. We're going to try and find the right recipe of treatment ingredients. And we're always going to be focusing on what's your quality of life, what's your function, and trying to avoid things that will take you down a path that will limit your longevity.
What are some options other than medications that you've seen help patients with chronic pain?
Well, there are many options for treatment that do not involve medications that would depend on the underlying pain problem. There might be situations in which you would recommend different forms of psychotherapy, coping skills training, or problem-solving skills. There are conditions for which you would recommend specific types of physical therapy to try to help the person be more functional and active in their environment. And there are other forms of therapy that might focus on meditation or mindfulness or yoga to help people deal with the anxiety and distress of their condition.
And are those things effective, or do patients look at you and say, come on. Yoga?
Sure. I think with any therapy, it's important to have the patient's engagement and acceptance. And that's part of the art of this practice. There are some people for which meditation comes very naturally and is already in some way part of their daily life. So those patients move into this kind of work very easily. There are other people who say exactly that. What are you talking about? And how? I don't have any interest in doing that. So you have to look for another type of therapy that will fit with them.
How do you, give me a scenario. How do you talk to a patient if they are really not into trying those kinds of approaches?
Well, generally, I start by asking the patient if they're currently doing well and or satisfied with the type of treatment they're using. And the patient generally says that they're not, or else they wouldn't be there seeing me. As I begin to discuss what's wrong with them and what I think the potential options are, I'm trying to describe for them a recipe of treatment modalities that will come together to help them be more functional. And as I lay those out, I ask them to think about how it is that they could do more, that they could be more engaged with the type of treatment, and that we're trying to move away from just the passive process of taking medications and being focused on pills and illness.
What are some things that you see on the horizon if you're being hopeful and optimistic in terms of treating people's pain?
Well, I think you're going to continue to see a number of medications in the pipeline. I think you're going to continue to see a development of mechanisms by which we try to prevent or avoid the abuse of opioid medications, such as dispensing pill bottles that cannot be tampered with and that will deliver medication at specified times to prevent overuse. And I think that you will see an increase in engagement from the healthcare community at large. We are all trying to think about how to work better together and communicate with one another about best practices, because the biggest problem we have really is just ignorance. It's well-meaning ignorance, but the everyday practitioner has not been taught about pain, is not comfortable with its various treatments, and so tends to default to what they've always done or what is simplest, and that gets us into trouble.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Clark is the director of the Chronic Pain Treatment Program at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. I recently went to an event in Philadelphia where medical students and doctors talked very openly about mental health challenges they experience on the job. Now, I've covered mental health for many years, and it was surprising to see that level of honesty coming from professionals known for their ability to handle almost anything. Long work days, delivering terrible news, losing patients. And this evening I attended was part of a nationwide series of events to prevent physician suicide. Burnout and poor mental health are big problems in this profession, and many experts say they begin in med school. There is a growing push to change the no sleep, be tough, keep pushing on attitude that's long been associated with the training. Duri Buscarin reports.
Just over a year ago, John and Michelle Deal joined what they say is a club nobody wants to be a part of, parents who have lost their children.
I was literally not able to walk through the grocery store. I couldn't do it because I would see his favorite foods.
Their son Kevin was a medical student at A.T. Stills University in rural Missouri, with big brown eyes and dark hair. Looking at family photos, he's hanging out on the beach or playing an upright bass with his younger sister. His father, John, remembers how Kevin would train for marathons on a treadmill in the basement.
So he was very, very resourceful. There was a point in time in his first 2 years where he was having difficulty with some of the testing. So he sliced open all of his books. I still have them downstairs. And he fed them through the scanner, and he let his computer read them back to him. And that did it.
His father says Kevin struggled with depression throughout his time in medical school, but thought that getting therapy would come up when he applied for jobs later. His parents pleaded with him to seek counseling, which he did, out of town, under a fake name, Payne Cash.
We didn't know what we were looking at, right? But when we talked to one of his friends, his very close classmates, he told us that he had talked to Kevin in the third year. And he said, Kevin, I think you're having a mania. And he said, you know why I didn't say anything? Because about 20 to 30% of our kids in our class were doing the same thing.
Kevin Deal took his own life just weeks before graduation. He was 26. 300 to 400 physicians die by suicide in the U.S. every year, according to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Medical schools aren't required to report suicides among their students, so it's hard to know how often this happens. But on the campus of St. Louis University School of Medicine, not too far away from where Dill grew up, people are trying to see if there's a better way to do this. The best example for how it works might be the jam band in the medical school's basement. The six members of the band call themselves the Palpations, which guitarist Tony Zunica explains is a medical pun that stuck.
We were doing anatomy, and during clinical anatomy, you're often told to palpate this and palpate that and try and find these nerves and these veins and so on and so forth.
St. Louis U has spent 8 years trying to cut back on rates of student depression and anxiety, which they measure every year as a kind of barometer for how they're doing. The school got rid of letter grades for first and second year classes, meaning you either pass or fail. And the content covered in those classes is scaled down about 10%, meaning that students actually have free time. Hyun Lee, who hopes to become a cardiothoracic surgeon, is the band's drummer, and he says band practices are a welcome release.
You know, I come into med school with the mentality of I'm just going to study 24/7 for 4 years. I'm just going to pretend like my life is over and just do it. But, you know, that's not possible. You know, you just need a place where you can go and do something other than palpating people, I guess.
Vincent Lee, who also plays guitar, says knowing how to balance classwork and the band is simply practice for life as a doctor.
And when I get out there, I want to be a doctor, but I also want to have a life. I want to have a family. So making time for my hobbies and things that I love and not letting go of those is really important to me.
Other students say they spend the extra time volunteering, hanging out with friends, or just doing basic things like going to the grocery store and getting their hair cut. Here's why St. Louis U felt they had to do this. 8 years ago, administrators measured the rates of depression and anxiety among their students for the first time. More than a quarter of students reported moderate to severe symptoms of depression after their first year of med school. 57% reported symptoms of anxiety.
I felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach. I was so shocked.
Dr. Stuart Slavin, the Associate Dean of Curriculum, says he was blown away.
And there was a sense of personal responsibility. We had evidence that when students started here, they looked like the general public. So as Associate Dean for Curriculum, it was like, you know, we are doing this to them, right? And I'm kind of responsible.
In addition to having more free time, every student takes a seminar in mental well-being and resilience, taught by Dr. Slavin. Anatomy, the course where first years dissect a human cadaver, is no longer the first class they ever take. In the meantime, Slavin says, average scores on board exams have actually increased from 222 to 229, although the national average has also gone up.
People think that by backing off, oh, you know, our medical students aren't going to be as well prepared. There's evidence that they're actually better prepared despite, you know, making life easier for them.
And maybe the biggest difference is that students say they're encouraged to seek out help, like Catherine Hu, a third-year student.
Anything medical just bears that weight of I'm going to be helping someone, and if I don't know what I'm doing, I could be hurting them, or I could be inadvertently causing harm to other people around me.
During her first year in St. Louis, Hu says she struggled with anxiety and the feeling that she didn't measure up. So she started meeting with Dr. Slavin regularly and keeping a journal of three positive things that happened every day.
It could be really anything from, I got to talk to my sister today on the phone, or I saw a really cool movie today, and it's actually kind of nice. It's kind of like a condensed diary, so when you flip through the ones that you've written before, you can say like, oh yeah, I did have a really good week that week.
After that first year, Hu says things are easier now. She's not sure what specialty she wants to go into yet, but she's excited for the future.
If you take care of yourself and establish these good habits early, you'll be more successful as a physician and you'll be more successful to take care of patients.
By St. Louis U's most recent count, just 4% of students had symptoms of depression after their first year of classes. That's about a fifth of where they were before the curriculum changes. But these efforts aren't always popular. Dr. Stephen Ray Mitchell is the dean of students at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., one of the most competitive medical schools in the country. He says some professors scoffed at the idea of going to pass-fail classes.
I was actually in favor of it, but people of my generation would say, oh, wait a minute, you can't do that because it will unfairly handicap the student when they're competing for residencies.
Then, a group of second-year medical students started to lobby administrators, saying this really makes a difference.
They would sit down with the people who opposed them and say, help me understand what it is that you don't like about it.
When the board voted again, the decision was unanimous. Following St. Louis University's cue, Georgetown has also started taking assessments of their students' mental health. And they're not alone. A petition calling for the professional associations for American medical colleges and residency programs to track student and physician suicides and to enact policies to prevent them now has about 75,000 supporters, including Kevin Deal's parents. They say efforts like this make them hopeful that what happened to their son can be prevented for others. But there's a long road ahead.
There are others out there who could be going through this, and we want to make sure that we make them aware that there are things you should look out for, and for people who's had this happen to them, that it's, they're not alone, you know?
For The Pulse, I'm Duri Bouscarin.
Duri is a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Sky-high prices for prescription drugs have made a lot of headlines recently. $600 EpiPens, $1,000 Hep C pills, cancer drugs that cost as much as a luxury car. And most patients stuck with a big price tag deal with their frustrations by venting on social media. But a group of California biohackers is taking a radically different approach. Even though they are not trained scientists, they are attempting to make their own medicine, in their case, insulin. From the Bay Area, Andrew Stelzer reports.
What would happen if your high school science and art classes were forced to be held together in the same space? It might look something like counterculture labs.
Let's turn all the way up. And here it goes.
Funded in part by a Kickstarter, it's an all-volunteer biohacking lab in Oakland, California. Biohacking, in case you're unfamiliar with the concept, is an evolving term, but basically it means citizen science, people doing research and experiments on their own, not usually affiliated with a university or corporation. At this lab, anyone can walk in off the street and get involved in projects, like Tamari Kurtadze, who at the moment is helping extract DNA from mushrooms.
If you're interested and you're willing to do something, you're willing to read up on, you know, procedures and come and help out in any way you can, we are welcoming to people. I've seen other hackerspaces where they require you to take certain classes before they allow you to do anything.
It's colorful and chaotic, with flyers all over the walls and workspaces scattered around. There's a pounding noise coming through the ceiling from a dance class upstairs. But past the line of blue masking tape on the floor where the three donated lab benches sit, there's no food or drink allowed, and it's more or less clean and sterile. Today's projects include a group trying to engineer vegan cheese, a fermentation workshop, and over by the autoclave, the Open Insulin Project is in full swing.
So the little bit of glowiness is maybe a sign that our E. coli has made the proinsulin stuff because it is fused with green fluorescent protein.
A group of volunteers is shining an ultraviolet light onto a petri dish. If they see a green fluorescent glow, it's a protein, and it could be attached to an insulin precursor. Project co-founder Anthony DeFranco, who has type 1 diabetes himself, is leading the group.
There have been a couple occasions where I've thought I've seen some very faint glow, but you know, that isn't anywhere near a conclusive result.
That glow, if they see it, is just one step in a long and improbable process. The idea is to modify the human insulin gene, shortening the complicated middle part, also called the C-chain, which would make it easier to make what's known as proinsulin. Proinsulin is a substance produced by the pancreas that helps most of us produce insulin. But type 1 diabetics don't make enough of it. The idea here is that if DeFranco and his fellow researchers could nail down the recipe for producing proinsulin, it would then be shared online. Everything here is open source, in hopes that one or more drug manufacturers would run with it and eventually bring a cheaper version of insulin to market. So why go through all this trouble? DeFranco says it's a matter of life or death.
Personally, I have access to insulin right now, because I live in a developed country and I'm in a decent financial position. If a generic could be brought to market and if production could be started in areas of the world where people don't have access, then that could save millions of lives and save millions of people from the complications of diabetes, which are quite grim and severe.
See, here's the thing. Unlike the medicines used to treat many common ailments, there is no generic insulin available to diabetics. A big part of the problem is that there are three giant companies, Eli Lilly, Sanofi, and Novo Nordisk, who own the patents to the commonly used forms of insulin. That means no one else is allowed to create it the same way. Thus, those three corporations dominate the market and control pricing. Aaron Little is the founder of Sucre Blue, a nonprofit supporting access and affordability for chronic disease treatment. She's also a type 1 diabetic and at times has struggled to find affordable insulin herself.
The kind of levels of desperation you see here in the U.S. are quite shocking in the sense that it's very, very common to use animal insulin. I've also heard really extreme things such as buying insulin off dead people or finding black market insulin.
That's just in the U.S. A 2010 survey by Health Action International found families in many less developed countries would need to spend a quarter to a half of their monthly income to buy one vial of insulin from a private pharmacy. And in some countries, an adequate supply of insulin simply doesn't exist because of both cost and corruption. So could a bunch of ragtag non-scientists in Oakland break Big Pharma's monopoly?
Within the access to medicine community, people are definitely watching this project.
Little says theoretically the Open Insulin Project could disrupt the market by creating a generic that didn't violate insulin's corporately owned patents. But there are huge financial and logistical challenges just to get a drug through the FDA's approval process.
It would save lives. It would be brilliant. But over the years, you do get kind of jaded in a sense where sometimes it's better to wait and see what happens than get your hopes up and then be very disappointed later when it doesn't happen.
Do you need, is that just broth or do you need agar as well?
Counterculture Labs co-founder Patrick Dazelier says the group knows their work will be difficult, but for him, it's not just about the product, but the process of demystifying science.
For a lot of these projects, if we were to turn them into a startup and get a couple of $1 million in funding, we could probably achieve our goal much faster. But we really feel that this kind of science needs to be democratized. This is going to be what will dominate our lives for the next many decades, I think. So we really want to educate as many people as possible to sort of know the way around the wet lab.
If everything goes well, the hope is that a new generic form of insulin might be only 1 or 2 years away from starting FDA trials, and that in nearby Silicon Valley, there could be some big money investors with an interest in funding medicine that goes against the capitalist grain. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Okay.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. America's national parks are hitting record numbers in terms of visitors. Seems fitting for the Park Service's centennial. And why do we go to these parks? To experience nature, wonder, awe, to get away from asphalt and smog and all that noise. It turns out, though, that finding a spot blissfully untouched by human noise can be much harder than one would think. The National Park Service released their first ever map of noise pollution across the U.S. earlier this year. Reporter Anne-Marie Awad is based in northern Colorado, and she went hiking to find out how noise affects nature.
I haven't lived in Colorado for very long, and I'm used to the clamor of big cities. This place has so many natural wonders that it's almost unfair. When Kurt Fistrup takes me out on a hike near Horsetooth Mountain in Fort Collins, I hear the wind moving through the trees, the chirping of meadowlarks, frogs croaking in a nearby stream. Fistrup hears planes. In fact, his ears are so attuned to that sound that he hears them even when my microphone can't pick them up.
There's our fifth jet overflight. It's an occupational hazard I have now. I keep count of aircraft noise that I hear.
Fistrup is a researcher with a little-known division of the National Park Service that's called Natural Sounds and Night Skies. He not only measures man-made noise in natural areas, but helps come up with solutions for curtailing it. According to his measurements, we're in one of the quietest places in northern Colorado. And yet, planes, seven of them, in less than 2.5 hours.
Yeah, for most of these birds, that low-frequency sound at that level probably has almost no impact. And for the frogs, the same. They probably are not as affected by it as much as you and I might be.
While this sound may only bother humans, that doesn't make it less important. Part of Fistrup's job, and the job of the Park Service, is to ensure that visitors to national parks are able to connect with nature.
The first thing is, if you perceive a noise, it can irritate you, annoy you, cause you to change your behavior. And that's true for people and for animals. The more subtle effect of noise is it masks other sounds. For humans, for park visitors, that means you lose the potential to see some rare animal when you can't hear the small sound that it happened to make. You know, that there might have been the crackle of a leaf or the sound of a footfall or maybe the snort of a deer, which you ordinarily would have heard, but with noise there, you just missed it.
Visitor experience is only part of the concern, though. Like Fistrup said earlier, low-frequency noises like airplanes flying overhead are a nuisance to humans. But other types of higher-frequency noises, like traffic, construction, or just rowdy people, are more than just a bother to animals.
For wildlife, missing that sound is much more vital, because these accidental sounds of nature are what sort of control all predator-prey interactions in parks and beyond.
This is part of why Fistrup's department released two maps earlier this year, one tracking noise, any noise, across the U.S., and the other measuring what the U.S. would look like without the presence of man-made noise.
It helps us understand the extent of noise in the United States, how broadly it's distributed, and where we might focus our attention in order to restore soundscapes to something like their natural condition.
They set up 600 microphones around the U.S. to help create a mathematical model. It predicts average sound levels at every point in between. Dan Mennett is the research scientist with Colorado State University who built that model.
When you look at the United States, there's just like such a huge range of diversity. We've got volcanic craters on Hawaii, some of the quietest places we've measured. They're so quiet they've defied our ability to actually measure them. And then at the same time, there's places like the Everglades that are just teeming with life. And all throughout the night, you can have insect choruses that are quite vibrant and loud. And at the same time, you know, we also have that diversity from small towns, larger cities, and everything in between.
Hence, two maps instead of one. This way they can tell which areas are problem areas for man-made noise and which areas are just naturally noisy, like the Everglades. This also marks the first time that these researchers have collected this type of data outside of national parks. They sampled other natural areas like the one Fistrup took me to, but also areas in and around big cities. And already, its applications are beyond what Fistrup's team had imagined. Researchers at Harvard, for instance, hope to use it to study the impact of noise pollution on cardiovascular health. But for Fistrup and others who work in conservation, the maps are first and foremost a tool to help preserve America's natural soundscapes. A few days after my hike with unofficial noise detective Kurt Fistrup, he takes me on another hike, this time on the other side of Fort Collins in a place called the Environmental Learning Center. We cross the creaky footbridge over a rushing river. The area is bordered on one side by a water treatment facility. And even as we hike out of earshot of all of that machinery, we still hear the faint sounds of construction on a road nearby. This is an example of a natural area where human impact on the environment is ever present.
I don't think we've ever quite gotten away from that construction noise off to the north. But all in all, I would still call this a nice place to walk. You know, in Fort Collins, it's great that we have these open spaces. There are many natural sounds out here worth the listening.
Fistrup is so attuned to the sounds of human influence in natural areas, he can't turn it off. But you or me, who don't research this for a living, can still enjoy the quiet of a local park or a stream. And he says that's crucial. If those experiences aren't available in people's communities, then they won't have an interest in protecting them on a larger scale. He says if people can truly experience nature, they're more likely to want to preserve the country's most beautiful natural treasures, like the Rocky Mountains or Great Sand Dunes here in Colorado. For The Pulse, I'm Anne-Marie Awad.
Anne-Marie is a reporter at KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. From noise that distracts us to noise that can change and uplift our mood, that would be music. Mohammed Naimuddin is an internal medicine resident at Temple University in Philadelphia, and he works in the intensive care unit. It's not a place where you tend to hear upbeat dance music pumping through the speakers, but during one of Naimuddin's shifts, he met a patient and a family that deeply touched his heart. And there was love, death, and Katy Perry. He told this story as part of an American College of Physicians story slam.
One day I walked in, and around 8 o'clock or so, we got called that there was a patient being brought in from the emergency room. We got all set up, and when he came, I found out it was a 30-year-old man. He had been found in his apartment by his parents after what seemed like a three-day absence. He had had a very bad asthmatic attack. And after not being found for 3 days, he had incurred a sizable injury to his brain. Everybody on the team knew what was going to happen, but none of us really could plan to tell it to the family right away. And over the next couple of days, I got to spend a lot of time with them as we figured out what exactly we should do and how to go about telling the family. You see, this family was a very large family and very loving. Eventually, all of us came to the same decision, every single neurologist, every cardiologist, every medical doctor, that there was nothing more that we could do. And when we informed the family of this, I was ready for the outcry and the sadness. And instead, what I got from his mom was, you know, all he really wanted when he died was to be an organ donor. Can you make that happen? And I said, yes, I can do what I can. And the next day, after all the tests were done and all the donors had been lined up, we took him to the OR. And the process goes that the patient gets extubated, and then they have 60 minutes to pass. And at that point, they can go with organ retrieval. And because the operating team cannot be the people that certify it, I had to go into the OR with him. And I went into the OR ready to get started, and his mom came up to me and she gave me an iPod and said, can you hook this up to the sound system so we can play this as our son dies? And I said, sure. The song started, and it started with Candle in the Wind. It's a really lovely song. Goodbye, Norma Jean. No, I never knew you. And I saw tears in everybody's eyes. And then My Heart Will Go On came on, and I thought that was also very appropriate. And then California Girls came on, and I thought, that's a little different. And then Katy Perry's I Want to Touch Your Peacock came on. And for those of you who haven't heard it, it goes, I want to touch your peacock, cock, cock. And everybody started laughing, and I started looking around and just wondering what's going on. And the family just started telling me about how amazing a person he was and how much he loved laughter, and he used to just do everything he could to bring joy to their lives, and that's how they were going to remember him. And then the rest of the playlist was just outlandish and beautiful, and it became a dance party at some point. It was very weird, but it was very sweet, and I just loved every part of it. Unfortunately, the 60 Minutes came and went, and he had not passed, and so I told them that he could no longer be an organ donor. And they were sad, but they knew that everything had been done that could have been done. And we brought him back to the intensive care unit. And since it was the end of my shift, I told the family that I'm so sorry for everything and the way it happened, but that I will be there for them tomorrow if he is still here. And when I went home that day, and I couldn't really sleep because I had gotten to know this family so well. Instead of going back to sleep, I just went, grabbed a couple of boxes of pizza, and went to the waiting room. And I spent more time with them. And while they went in and out of his room, I waited with them, and they told me all about his life and how amazing he was and how just everything that he did brought joy to their lives and how much they would miss him. And all I could think was, this is a lovely person, and he had such an impact on this family, and he's never going to go because they're always going to have him in their hearts. Thank you.
Mohammed Naimuddin is an internal medicine resident at Temple University in Philadelphia. He told this story as part of an American College of Physicians story slam. Paige Flager produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, Todd Bookman, and Irina Zhorov. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next week on The Pulse, natural history museums bring to mind dioramas with stuffed polar bears and perhaps behind-the-scenes drawers overflowing with dusty specimens.
No, there's no better hoarder than a natural history museum, I can tell you that.
But some scientists say they are the frontier for new groundbreaking research.
That eureka moment of opening a drawer, opening a box, and seeing something.
Something amazing.
There is no greater high, there's no greater excitement than that thrill of discovery.
The future of natural history museums. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.